don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to Education Nation, where every Saturday morning at 10:30, we grab our second cup of coffee and tackle the biggest issues in American education. Your host is the headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hagstrom, along with co-host Mark Durkin. School is now in session.
Well, good morning, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I'm your host, Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's always such a pleasure and privilege to be with you on Saturday mornings. I'm joined in studio once again by the producer of Education Nation and co-host, Mark Durkin.
And another good morning to you, Rebecca.
Another good morning to you, Mark. So this morning, we want to continue our detailed conversation about a learning disability that is more common than the average person might think. It's estimated, as I mentioned last week, that 1 in 10 people in the U.S. have dyslexia and that 40 million American adults are dyslexic, but only 2 million know it. Pretty shocking statistic there. And with that amount of people, or with that number of people unaware, you can see why so many people suffer with dyslexia and how they might struggle with feelings of inferiority. As we mentioned last week, and we'll do so again today, dyslexia is not an issue with intelligence or motivation. Having dyslexia is in no way means that you are lazy or dumb. There are programs and training curriculums that have helped countless dyslexic persons thrive exactly as they were designed to thrive.
And before anyone who might suspect they have dyslexia can begin to take action, they first have to know what dyslexia is and is not. Well, we discussed this last week, as well as what is fact and what is myth. We addressed how it affects learning and early signs to look for in children all the way up to the fourth grade and beyond. Well, this morning on Education Nation, we want to inform you, the parents, on what actions you can take if you suspect dyslexia in your child. We also want to equip parents with necessary training to help their children thrive academically.
Yep, and the very person to help us do that once again is Shirley Marsh. Welcome to Education Nation, Shirley.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, we're very grateful to have you. And Shirley is a learning specialist for students with dyslexia and helps students with their reading at Liberty Classical Academy. Shirley also has a master's degree in special education and is trained in the Orton-Gillingham approach, which we will discuss at length later on in the show. So again, welcome back. And Shirley, I'm going to jump right in with you this morning because we don't want to waste any time. What should parents do if they suspect that children show signs of dyslexia?
That's a really good question. Yep. I hope as parents that you can make it fun with your kids. Make it fun. There are some great games out there like Candyland and Chutes and Ladders that just teach kids processes of going in a direction. So, and counting. Those are great board games to play. Mm-hmm. Other card games like Uno are really fun to play, where they have to be learning those colors in a fun way, counting in a fun way, learning their numbers in a fun way. Reading nursery rhymes to your children is a really, really, really great way to work on rhyming. Mm-hmm. And when you're driving in the car, which I know all parents drive in the car with their kids, play games with sound. You can go around the car rhyming words. You can make it fun with song. There's lots of songs out there that have rhymes at the end. And you can play words or word games like bug, banana, blue, finding words that all start with that first sound of b. Just playing with our language is so important at an early age. And then having puzzles at home that have the alphabet where the kids have to match the letters to the spaces. Having those train puzzles where there's alphabet letters and they have to lay them out in order. Those are all great activities for kids and for parents to make it fun. If it's not fun, if you're trying and it's not fun at the earliest age possible, reach out to someone that is a psychiatrist, a psychologist that specializes in language processing. Sometimes it's a speech and language therapist at the beginning. But start early. Don't be afraid of it. And don't think that by doing that, somehow you're thinking that it's dyslexia. Parents like to have peace of mind, and just doing something often brings that.
Yeah, good advice to not be afraid of it, but to actually approaching a professional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I'm going to bring you back to the car ride. I'm thinking, in today's world, are you actually asking them to not let their kids play with iPads in the car or not watch the movie on the TV? You're saying playing actual games.
It's about balance.
It was when I was little, when we played the alphabet game in the car.
So when you have them strapped
in. License plate game.
Exactly. That's another great game.
Yes. Yep. We all played that because we did not have TVs in the car.
That's right. Fun.
So you mentioned an evaluation, and where would you recommend parents bring their children to have that evaluation? You mentioned a psychologist, but there are some specific places even right here in the Twin Cities that you recommend, and we recommend at Liberty, and maybe you could name some of those.
Sure. A specific school that is in the metro area that works with kids who have disabilities. It's called Groves Academy. It's in St. Louis Park, and they are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. That's a great place. The University of Minnesota has a great program and a great process for assessment. There is a place out in Minnetonka, and Nancy Foster is a neuropsych that works there, and I've known her for over 20 years. And Partners in Healing is that clinic, but I find her phenomenal as well.
So. And Fraser Center is another one.
Fraser's another great, great place. And if you're in the public school system, starting with your public school and with the people right there, that's another great place to start.
Right.
Yep.
And can you tell us just very briefly about the process that your child would go through then?
Right. If you as a parent are taking the initiative and going to a neuropsych, you know, they're going to interview you, get to know you over the phone, and they are just going to bring you in for a day with your child. They might meet with you previously without your child there, but they're going to have you come in with your child. And to prep your child, it's a fun day. Kids who go, they do a lot of puzzles and playing, and a good neuropsych is trying to take a really good picture of all that a child has going on, the strengths and the weaknesses. And they look at the whole child. And they don't go in looking for something. They go in looking for, who is this child? And then from that, they take the results to be able to say, okay, these are the strengths and these are the weaknesses. And if a diagnosis is in place, that's where they go.
And that's process. Really helpful. It takes some of the fear away of, what does it mean to have my child evaluated? That word evaluation sounds so scary. And so to know that it really is just sitting down and talking with someone and having them play some games and do some work with your child, it's much less intimidating to know that process.
And depending on the age of the child, if they're already in school, they'll be doing more of an academic piece to it, where they're looking at their math skills and their reading skills and their writing skills and all the components to reading and writing and spelling and math and subtests that are involved. And once again, it's fun. It is fun for the kids, but it can be painful too. So explaining to children that they're going to be doing a little math, a little reading, and a little writing. And the beauty of, you know, nationally normed tests is that there's a ceiling involved. So kids, once it becomes too difficult, it's over.
Right,
it doesn't get to a painful place. And also for parents to know that when they go in to meet a neuropsych, they are doing an intelligence test. But if you don't want to know your child's IQ, you don't have to know your child's IQ. That does not have to be computed.
That's a good piece of good recommendation.
Yeah.
I can get the words out here this morning. So what would you say is appropriate instruction for a person with dyslexia?
You mentioned that I use the Orton-Gillingham approach. The broader piece of Orton-Gillingham is that it's a multi-sensory approach, and it's language-based instruction. And there's some really big words that go along with that. But if I could just read to you a definition of multi-sensory teaching, I think that would give you an idea of what it is exactly that I'm talking about. It's one important aspect of instruction for dyslexic students that is used by clinically trained teachers. Effective instruction for students with dyslexia is explicit, it's direct, it's cumulative, it's intensive, and it's focused on the structure of our language. Multisensory learning involves the use of visual, auditory, and kinesthetic tactile pathways simultaneously to enhance memory and learning of our written language. That's a lot. But if I were to explain it to you, the best way to teach a child who has dyslexia is to start with the small pieces. So you start with the language at its base, which are each sounds that our letters make. And from there, you build on their knowledge base, what they know. You keep adding more letters to their repertoire, and then you start to build words. And you start to show kids how our words are built. They're built with syllables. Beyond cat, then you have two-syllable words like open, and you teach them directly and explicitly, and you don't assume they're going to pick up on things through osmosis. You literally teach them everything of our language, and their eyes are opened to how brilliant our language is and how it's put together, and that the puzzle starts to fall into place for them. Mm-hmm. But it starts at that sound level, that base level, and when I say that it's visual, that it's auditory, and that it's kinesthetic, and another quote here I have by a former president of the IDA of America. She says, dyslexic students need a different approach to learning language from that employed in most classrooms. They need to be taught slowly and thoroughly the basic elements of their language, the sounds and the letters which represent them, and how to put these together and take them apart. They have to have lots of practice in having their writing hands, their eyes, their ears, and their voices working together for conscious organization and retention of their learning. Mm-hmm. So it's very hands-on when you're doing multisensory. They're saying things, they're hearing things, they're writing things, they're using their hands to trace letters on the table. When they go to spell, they're using their fingers to spell, using every sound to build those words. Mm-hmm. And all of that goes mm-hmm. together in their minds to formulate our language.
Wow. And that brings us to our next question.
Sure.
And you may have already defined it for us with
there,
the multisensory definitions. That's
yeah,
okay. But
I did.
Is there anything uh-huh. that parents of children with dyslexia should look for when they're considering preschools?
Good question. Make sure that preschool is using an alphabetic approach, that they are teaching our alphabet and they're teaching it systematically. Also that with that, then, that it's multisensory. The kids are not just looking at letters, but they're actually making them out of clay. They're using their large muscles, big motions to show how you make the letter C. Mm-hmm. You start big with, I know you, I said you start small, but mm-hmm. with your large motor, you want to start big with your motor to build
the
these letters.
Small letters, yes.
To make the small letters. Because yeah. at the beginning, you don't have a pencil in their hand,
right?
You're using mm-hmm. your arms to make a C. Mm-hmm. And look for those kind of preschools that do a lot of music and a lot of play with our language, like I talked about previously. And if your preschool is going to be a preschool that has pencils, you really want to have a preschool that is going to teach the kids to actually write the letters in the correct way rather than just drawing the letters. Mm. My oldest son had an E in his name, and when he was little, he knew there were lines going horizontally in the letter E in the uppercase, but he had about 5 lines going across. And it's cute when they're little, but as kids are actually needing to learn to write them, to teach them that the correct stroke is so important because muscle memory is really, really strong. And to have to go backwards with that is hard. So look mm-hmm. for preschools that are, they kind of have it going on with all those things.
See, that's a good reminder for me. My 4-year-old will be going into kindergarten, and I've kind of gotten away a little bit from the sheets we received last year that showed the appropriate stroke. So it's a good reminder.
get them back out, Mark.
It's not the end of the world. But, right. Those are good programs that are doing those things.
Sure.
So,
yep. Well, another good analogy, anyway, is one of a ladder as it pertains to our language system. Could you describe what that means?
Sure. I really like this. And it's not mine. It's from Cecil L. Stein, who wrote how our language development is like a ladder. And she describes the ladder as having the bottom rung of the ladder being the sounds of our language. So as we're learning our language, we're first learning those sounds. And then as you go up to the next rung, you recognize that those sounds go together and you can build words. Okay, so then the third rung is where syntax comes into play. And now we're taking these words that we've been building and we're formulating sentences. And we're learning that these sentences have meaning. And that's on the fourth rung where the meaning becomes very important, because then you're beyond just sentences, but you're getting into paragraphs and word knowledge and vocabulary. And it's just putting it all together and really getting the true message of what print is all about and stories are all about and sentences are all about. And then the top rung of our ladder, because it's a kind of short ladder, but this top part is huge. It has every bit of knowledge that you have acquired over the course of your life. And so if you think about the process of learning to read and you are on the bottom rung, mm-hmm. but you're stuck there and you're in fourth grade, you're still putting those sounds together, but everyone around you is writing sentences, how frustrating mm-hmm. that can be. Mm-hmm. And everyone's top rung is different depending on where they've lived, how their parents have spent time talking to them or not spent time talking to them, what books they've read or have had read to them. Right. Just each of their experiences has a different top rung. So, you know, to be able to apply all you've learned in life, if you're still stuck on that first rung, is really frustrating mm-hmm. for kids.
It's a great analogy.
Isn't that great? Yes. I love it. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love it.
Very visual.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, Sherilee Marsh will share with us a top instructional approach that is instrumental in her helping children overcome the challenges presented by dyslexia. Stay tuned.
We don't need no thought control.
Welcome back to Education Nation. I'm your host, Rebecca Hagstrom, joined with my co-host, Mark Durkin, and Liberty Learning Specialist, Sherilee Marsh. We want to spend the rest of today's show discussing specific instructional methods that teachers and parents can learn to help children with dyslexia thrive in the classroom. So the Orton-Gillingham method, we mentioned that earlier, that you are trained in the Orton-Gillingham method, and it's a reputable instructional approach when it comes to helping those with dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So who were Samuel Orton and Anna Gillingham?
Oh, very good question, and I get asked that a lot. It just almost sounds like, I don't know, who is this?
Yeah.
One person, but it's actually two people, and actually if you looked at the whole picture, it was more than two people, but those two names have been associated with the method.
Okay.
Just a little background. Samuel Orton was in a clinic in the 1920s, and he was working with adults who had some sort of a brain injury, and they were relearning how to read.
Hmm.
But he was using multisensory techniques, and he was influenced by Grace Fernald and Helen Keller and how she was learning. So that multisensory piece was what he was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested that kinesthetic tactile reinforcement of visual and auditory associations could correct the tendency of confusing similar letters and transposing the sequence of letters while reading and spelling.
Hmm.
And he then, Anna Gillingham, he worked with Anna Gillingham, who was a teacher. So
okay.
he knew what was going on, but he needed a teacher to come alongside him.
Sure.
I don't know if he needed, but the two of them worked then together where she understood how to teach and he understood what was going on, and they put it all together with that multisensory approach to teaching.
Very
reading and spelling.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
Sure.
And
I,
without going too far off base,
yeah.
I am kind of curious, are they the only ones that have done this approach, or are there other similar approaches, and what are maybe some of the differences with those?
Sure. Teachers and developers have made other programs based on Orton-Gillingham, and that phrase I see time and time again on, this is based on Orton-Gillingham, this is based on Orton-Gillingham. Mm. But the true Orton-Gillingham method was never a curriculum. It was an approach.
Got it.
And to try to explain that to you, it would be really fun, and maybe a way for me to show you how it works. I'd be happy to do that right now.
Sure,
you want
sure,
me to.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you're looking at what I mentioned before, which is multi-sensory instruction,
mm-hmm.
It had some different components being visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. But along with that, I defined it a little bit more broadly. And these are the real specific components of learning to read and spell using a multisensory approach.
Okay.
You're doing visual at the same time you're doing auditory, at the same time you're doing kinesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, they're not separate. But for example, I would say, okay, we're going to spell cat. So Rebecca, you'll say,
Kuh.
Just say the word cat for
cat.
Me, please.
Okay.
Cat, okay. And now I'm going to have you break that down. And we're going to break it down by sound. So we have k-a-t. Okay, and if you could see me on the radio, which you can't, I'm holding up my hand. And I'm, for every finger on my left hand moving from left to right, I'm putting a sound on each finger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying k-a-t. And then I'm going to go to write that k-a-t. I'm using my mouth to say the sounds, and I'm using my fingers. And I've heard it, so I've got all of that going on at
mm-hmm.
once.
Mm-hmm.
So in a typical lesson in an Orton-Gillingham approach, kids are saying things, they're hearing me say things to them, they're hearing themselves say things back, and then they're writing it. So they have all of those three components going on at
mm-hmm.
once. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Very interesting.
The mm-hmm. next thing is that it's systematic and it's cumulative. So what that means is when I first meet a child and I do a little assessment with them to figure out what they know, because I want to build off what they know. So if they come to me and they know most of their consonant letters and sounds, and I see that because I've had them read lists of words to me and I've had them spell words for me, and I can see that they're using a set number of letters and maybe even digraphs, say like SH or TH, they're using those together correctly in their spelling and in their reading. If I can see that, then I know where to start. But often for kids, it's the vowels that are the trickiest. Mm-hmm. And so we just start one by one, and systematically we work on one vowel at a time. So if we've started on short A, which is where I like to start, we build words with short A, we read words with short A until that fluency piece is coming together. They're reading cat, sat, mat, fan, ran, and it's not k, a, t, because at that point they're not reading yet. Mm-hmm. They're still sounding it out and they're doing it the right way, but it's not at a place where I'm feeling comfortable to move on to the next vowel, because the minute I introduce a second vowel, it can be confusing for them. Mm-hmm. So it's systematic and it's cumulative, so it's building upon one another, but there's a sequence of events that have to take place for these kids. So that's what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And then direct instruction means I leave nothing to chance. I don't want to assume that because they read the word said, that's a sight word, that now they're going to spell the word said. I'm going to explicitly teach them and directly tell them, this is the word said. It's all over the place in the books you're going to be reading, and we spell it S-A-I-D. And then I combine all of those multisensory components to that to teach them that piece. But mm-hmm. it's the same thing with non-phonetic words. Everything is direct, and I'm not leaving anything to chance and assuming they're just going to pick it up along the way. They might, but I'm still going to teach them, because there's nothing worse than me looking at across the table from a child and say, I bet you already know this, and then to have them not really know it. Right. That's mm-hmm. deflating.
Right.
I'm just going to tell them and just move on from there.
Right.
So
right.
That's that. And then that diagnostic is another word I threw in there. When I'm working with my students, I'm always diagnosing what's going on, and I'm thinking, okay, last week I thought you were pretty solid on that short A, but this week it's just not there. So I'm not ready to move on. I'm going to stay with short A. It's not like a curriculum where lesson one is here, lesson two is here, lesson three, and you just follow it. You are constantly moving backwards and forwards at the pace that's necessary for that child. Mm-hmm. But that's why the training is so important, to understand what's going on with dyslexia, but also with this approach that just picking up a curriculum that says it's based on Orton-Gillingham doesn't really mean that you are truly understanding what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I right. really, really enjoy it.
And go ahead. Before we go on, maybe you could just point out that mm-hmm. it's a very extensive training. I know that
sure.
we've had other teachers that are starting
yep.
to go through the process,
yep.
and I think it's four different levels, right?
There
training?
Are right now. There are four different levels, and different states do different things. Different organizations do different things. Here in Minnesota, we have a nonprofit called Orton-Gillingham of Minnesota. And I actually am a teacher with them, and I really believe in what they're trying to do, which is to educate both parents and teachers. And we have both come through our programs. But level one, level two, level three, and then there's a fourth level right now where teachers and these parents that come, often parents who have children with dyslexia, want to know how to help their kids at home. They're learning the structure of our language at the same time that they are learning how to teach their children and their students the structure of our language. And that's why it takes so long, because our language structure is not crazy. It's not at all crazy, but it's very sophisticated. Our language, English, is based on other languages, mm-hmm. and it's constantly evolving, because as other cultures move into our country, we are learning new words. You know, the word taco or mm-hmm. the word, you know, sushi. Those mm-hmm. are not English American words, but they are in our language. So just think of how complicated our language is constantly becoming for kids mm-hmm. and confusing for them. And so when you ask the question that it's extensive, mm-hmm. It is, and it takes time. And really, the beauty of Orton-Gillingham in Minnesota is that while you're taking the classes, the summer classes are 2 weeks long, you have lecture, and then you have a practicum where you actually work with two different children every day for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So you can see what happens in the process from day one to day 10, and just that little bit of time, how much kids learn using this approach. Mm-hmm. It's phenomenal.
Really
so,
great.
Yep.
Yeah. It's very good.
You know, we thank you so much for explaining the method in detail.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
that really covered a lot of ground. But if you could think of a couple of bullet points mm-hmm. of why you personally, Cheri Lee, mm-hmm. emphasize and employ the method of this study explicitly at LCA, what might be some of those bullet points?
Definitely. Not all children need to have direct instruction in learning to spell and read. There are a population of kids and adults out there that just almost learned to read through osmosis. They did. Mm-hmm. You know, you showed them the book and they mm-hmm. were reading it. It's crazy that it happens. Our brains are amazing. But for those that it doesn't work that way, the only way in a classroom to make sure that all kids are learning is to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And within a classroom, you know, at Liberty, you've got a broad spectrum. And the teachers that are being trained are able to identify those kids that are struggling early on and not just drag them through the school year, but actually pinpoint where they're at. And we can work with them and allow them to learn at the pace they need to be at, so that by the time they truly need to be reading independently on their own, mm-hmm. they're doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's our goal. Mm-hmm. So.
Sure. Well, why don't we transition here mm-hmm. a little moment? Now, we've gone ahead and talked about the method in detail mm-hmm. now, and teachers and how they're being trained sure. and how you're training them. How can parents mm-hmm. acquire this training?
They can take a class through Orton Gillingham in Minnesota. And I also encourage all of my students that I work with, I encourage their parents to sit in on lessons and to be involved in teaching their kids to read. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, though, I'll be honest that parents have been trying and they're frustrated mm-hmm. and they're just ready for someone else to take the reins.
Sure.
And maybe at school it hasn't been happening and they're frustrated. It's complicated. And so parents, I would encourage you to get the training, especially if you have a child with dyslexia. It's costly to have a person like myself over the course of a lifetime work with your child privately. And the more that you can do will speed up the process mm-hmm. of kids learning to read and spell. So I would encourage that. And also just pick up a good book about dyslexia to just learn more about it mm-hmm. and to just educate yourself, because knowledge is power.
Right.
Right. And being able to advocate for your kids, wherever that is mm-hmm. is powerful. Mm-hmm. So, yep.
So you mentioned one resource. Are there any other mm-hmm. special resources that you would like parents to check out to address their children's needs?
Sure. The website for the International Dyslexia Association is a wealth of knowledge. If you just Google that, International Dyslexia Association. And we also mentioned the Yale Institute, which is where Sally Shaywitz is. Her book, Overcoming Dyslexia, is a great book written about, I'm going to say about a decade ago now. But on that website, there is just a wealth of information for you as parents. And even for parents who don't already have a child with a diagnosis, but they're curious about it. On both of those websites, there are little tests, if you want to call them tests. I don't mm-hmm. know. But just like question and answers where you can say, yes, this is happening. No, this isn't happening. And at the end, okay, maybe your child has dyslexia mm-hmm. that you can kind of.
So it's almost like a simple questionnaire to kind
That's
of just
right
decide whether
yeah.
or not you
right.
have a problem
yeah.
that might be significant enough to have it checked out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Very, very good.
Right.
All right. Did you have any other resources you wanted to give us?
Those two websites are a great place to start, but okay. also then right here in Minnesota, we have another branch of IDA, and it's the Upper Midwest branch of the International Dyslexia Association. How about okay. that for a mouthful?
Yes.
But if you do Google IDA of Minnesota, you can find it that way too. And they have a conference that's actually going on all day today.
And I think right you're here. Speaking, if I remember
I am,
correctly.
Yeah, I am. Humbled by that one. Yeah. But I am, that's another great place you could start if right away you would
Fantastic.
Right here in Minneapolis.
And look at the IDA website, right?
Right.
Okay,
correct.
For more
yep.
information.
Right.
Well, that is all the time that we have for this week's episode of Education Nation. And we want to thank you, Cheryl Lee, for your comprehensive and in-depth detail into this really very important discussion on dyslexia. We know that this was a great wealth of knowledge for listeners who are living with dyslexia, and we also hope it was an encouragement. We also look forward to our discussion with you next week as we tackle some additional learning disabilities, ADHD and auditory processing, how to spot them and how to treat them. And I know in our show last week, one of the things that you mentioned were that students with dyslexia often have trouble following directions or organization and some of these other things. And I know one of the thoughts that went through my mind is some of those sound like other types of learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so I asked you at one point, do we often see these two things in combination, or two or three learning disabilities in combination? Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can address that with us next week as well.
That would be wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you
so much for
yep.
joining us this week. And we'll see you next week on Education Nation.